Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've been through a time of high fundamentalism, then high skepticism about religion. Jerry Falwell, Christopher Hitchens. But meanwhile, millions of Americans are looking for a way that's something else. It may be in a church or temple or mosque. It may not. Spiritual, but not religious, is a box an awful lot of people might check these days. But what does that mean? This hour on Point, the spiritual path. You can join the conversation. Is that you? Spiritual, but not religious. What does that mean to you? What does it include, exclude? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from the studios of WGLT at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois, is Richard Watts. He served as a Presbyterian minister in Illinois churches for 24 years and as a staff member and consultant for the National Presbyterian Peacemaking Program. He's co-author with John Dominic Crossan of Who is Jesus? A look at the historical figure. He also happens to be my childhood minister. He preached, I listened as a boy. He's always been there. He buried my mother. His new book is Hungers of the Heart, Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century. Richard Watts, Dick Watts, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Wow, the circles do go round and round, sir. You were in the pulpit. I was just a punk in the pews, but I listened.
I know. Aren't you surprised I'm still sitting up and taking nourishment?
Yes, I'm glad you're still sitting up and taking nourishment, and I'm really interested in the path that you have walked since then. I mean, how many times back in the day there you were leading us all in the Lord's Prayer or the Nicene Creed, sort of the fundamental elements of Christian faith. And now you're writing in your new book, I invite you to dare to reimagine religion. What do you mean by that, Dick?
Well, exactly. You know, it's like you were saying, a lot of people, when they think about religion, they feel they've only got two choices. They either are turning on their TV at night and going from one channel to another where somebody is talking about the rapture or the end times or what they have to believe to be saved on the one hand, or on the other hand, they're going to Barnes & Noble and they're picking up the God delusion or God is not great, and a kind of a debunking of religion. And it's understandable that a lot of people are refusing to darken the doors of the churches, synagogues, and mosques if they think that those are the only two options. And so it's understandable that a lot of people are saying nowadays, well, I'm spiritual, yes, but not religious, by which I think they mean I've got questions about meaning. I want to find a purpose to my life. I have sometimes a wow experience. You know, isn't life amazing? And yet I can't really buy into, as you suggested, this or that creed or this or that institution. It makes a lot of sense that people are in that search to me.
So you say of that crew, and I guess here, Dick, you're including yourself as one of them. You say we are people of search, not certainty. So what's the framework in that case?
Well, it's possible to, it's possible to take the tradition seriously without taking it literally. And I think that's very important. A lot of people take texts without context. I mean, what we've got, for example, those of us who call ourselves Christians or Jews, we have a scriptural tradition. That tradition was not handed down from God from on high. It's not absolute. What it is, it's really not even a book. It's a library of books written over at least 1,000 years, and those books contain a variety of writings. There is history. There is mythology. There are legends. There are parables. There are short stories. There are poems, poetry, all of these kind of things, and we all know that you can't interpret all kinds of writings the same way. For example, when you're reading a poem, you don't ask whether things really happened that way or not. And all of us know that you can pick up a good novel and sometimes learn more about human nature than from a psychology textbook or a sociology book. And so this is the way we reappropriate the tradition by trying to find continuing meanings, even though we have changing language, changing understanding of the way the world is put together. So we neither despise the past as though it has nothing to teach us, nor are we bound in it like a straitjacket and unable to think in contemporary terms. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense, but at the same time, it raises questions. I really want to explore all that terrain. I'm sure that's the terrain where a lot of people live. But let me ask you, O spiritual guide of my youth, when you say the Bible is not handed down from on high, I mean, says who? The Christian Church certainly has taught for a long time that it is or was. When you call yourself a searcher, a person of search, not certainty, are you self-identifying still, O minister of my youth, as a Christian? Or have you evolved into something else, something more multifarious? Or does it even matter to you now?
Well, O child of my former parish.
Yes.
One thing perhaps you misremember, we never did recite the Nicene Creed.
Is that right?
Because back in those days also, I had a number of the same kinds of questions I have today,
okay.
And I've never believed that the way we express the faith needs to be limited by the words of the 5th century or the 15th century. So with that minor correction, I'll go on
some
to say
some other church,
that,
some know, other Sunday, I guess. Sorry.
Exactly. Fundamentalism passes itself off as the old-time religion. It really is not an old-time religion. Fundamentalism is an American product of the 20th century. It began actually in a series of pamphlets from 1910 to 1915, bankrolled by a couple of wealthy Presbyterians or laymen out in California.
Mm-hmm.
Pamphlets, 2.5 million pamphlets they distributed all over the country to ministers and church school teachers called The Fundamentals, in which they said that the virgin birth, the inerrancy of Scripture, the bodily resurrection, the second coming of Jesus, his atonement for sin, these were the fundamentals of the Christian faith. Well, what they were doing was they were reacting against modernity. They were circling the wagons against Darwinism and the idea of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
They were circling the wagons against the encounter with other world religions. They were circling the wagons against new biblical studies coming out of Europe, raising exactly critical questions about the Scriptures. So fundamentalism is not simply the old-time religion. It's a modern religion, which really is the flip side of those who take science to be a religion. If scientists were saying, okay, here's the way the world was created, the fundamentalists said, oh, no, we've got documents and we will read them as science. And they had not always been read as science in previous eras of church history. So that old-time religion isn't so old-time as people like to say.
So there's your critique of the fundamentalist path. You don't feel obligated to follow what was directed in a pamphlet in 19-whatever. You also have a critique that goes the other way, to the skeptics. And we've talked with lots of them here, Daniel Dennett and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and right on down. But you write that skepticism doesn't go deep enough. You say we need to be skeptical not only about the claims of religion, but also about the critique of it. What do you mean by that?
I do say that because I've read those books you referred to by Dawkins and Dennett. And
yeah, he's been here too.
Hitchens and Sam Harris. And, you know, there's a great deal of that I affirm. And in their critique of religion when they say, well, look, science and religion are not enough, says Hitchens. But I don't want anything that offends against reason or contradicts science. Most of the people that I know who inhabit our churches would say exactly the same thing, that religion, faith may go beyond what we know by science, but it never contradicts it. It may have intuitions that we find it hard to express in terms of secular reason, but it doesn't contradict that reason. And so I think part of the problem with those very popular writers who have a lot of legitimate critique, let me say. There was a famous missionary who said, my critics are the unpaid watchmen of my soul.
Yes.
And I always believe that. That's why I always read the critics, so that I can be honest. I want to be an mm-hmm. honest person. Mm-hmm. And but what they do is they take the worst excesses of Christianity over the centuries, especially the violent ones, and they take the most outrageous statements of contemporary fundamentalists, and they tar all religion with the brush of that outrageousness. And I think that's not intellectually very fair.
But there's something more than process of their critique that you're looking at here. When you say we need more skepticism, you're seeing a hunger of the heart, the name of your book, that goes beyond what they're offering on that kind of deep but dry
right.
critique. What's that hunger, Dick? We just got half a minute before the break, but give us a sense of it.
Yeah, there's a certain kind of scientism that is very reductive, that reduces everything to what you can weigh and measure. To take a very simple example, it's not a simple example, it's a complex one. We've had a great deal of study of sexuality in the last generation. Mm-hmm. We've had Kinsey reports and Masters and Johnson.
Sure.
And they can use their tools and they can examine everything that goes on from a kiss to an orgasm. And I don't know anybody who would say, oh, well, that explains what love is. Everybody knows that there's something going on in relationships that can be a whole lot deeper than what they can find with their measurements, what they can weigh and analyze. And that's what I refer to as hungers of the heart.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the millions of Americans who say they are spiritual, not religious, and what that means. My guest is Richard Watts. He's author of the new book, Hungers of the Heart, Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century. And the twist in the story today is that Richard Watts, Dick Watts, happens to have been my childhood preacher. I remember very well many years of listening to his teaching. I was lucky then and feel lucky today, Dick. I remember from that, you are a great storyteller. You cite four stories in here. I mean, it's interesting. You actually go to the faiths themselves to say, let's not lock ourselves around religious dogma too tightly. And you tell stories. You've got four stories, Jewish, Christian, and Hindu. And I wonder if you could just give us a brushstroke sharing of those stories to convey how you're sort of looking to religion for permission, in a sense, not to be too bound by dogma.
Well, exactly. I'd be glad to, Tom. Let me take the first of those stories, which is a story about Moses, mm-hmm. a story about Moses having a conversation with God. And, you know, Moses is pictured in the story as somebody who was God's friend. They would talk face to face in the
sort
luminous
of.
Cloud that
right.
was God's presence. Yeah. And there's a great story where Moses is leading these fractious, rebellious people, and he doesn't want to go unless he knows that the Lord is going to be with him. So he's talking to the Lord and he says, Lord, you know, show me your glory so that I'll know that you're going with us. And God in this story says, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. What I'll do is I'll put you in a cleft in that rock over there, and I'll pronounce my sacred name and I will pass by you. I'll put my hand over you. And when I pass you, I'll take my hand away. And you can see my back, but my face cannot be seen. Now, you know, what do we make of a story like that? Did it happen? No, of course it didn't happen. Is it true? Yes, it's true.
Because
how so? Because what the story is saying is even a Moses, a great spiritual hero, has only a partial knowledge of God, a partial glimpse of God, but never can see God in who he is, in his face, which carries his whole personality. So it's a parabolic story. It's a symbolic story that says, if you think that you know God and you got it all figured out, boy, are you mistaken.
Maybe four is too many, but give us the Hindu story, the Krishna story. You draw a similar lesson from it.
Well, it's a great story that Krishna, who many Hindus look at, kind of as many Christians look at Jesus as not only a historical being but God incarnate. Krishna is a cowherd in this story, and he invites milkmaids out into the forest for a great circle dance one night. And so they all go out there in the forest to dance with their Lord. And Krishna, being Krishna, miraculously multiplies himself so that he's dancing with every one of the milkmaids. Mm. And everything is great until they begin to think, each of them, that Krishna is dancing only with me. And then he disappears. Okay, so what's going on in that story? Mm-hmm. It really is a very similar kind of thing. There's plenty of God, plenty of the sacred, plenty of the spirit to go around to everybody. But as soon as you think that you're the only one who's got the sacred, you're the only one that God is dancing with, God disappears. I think that's, you know, a tremendous thing that we still need to hear, because we're in a world of exclusivisms where all kinds of people are saying, I've got it, you don't have it, too bad for you.
And that's the path you're pointing down. You also quote the, Saudi Arabian astronaut, I guess, on the space shuttle, Dick, who went up. This was Sultan bin Salman Al Saud. Back at Earth from the spaceship porthole, and you quote him saying, the first day or so we all pointed to our countries. The third or fourth day we were pointing to our continents. By the fifth day we were aware of only one Earth. What are you saying?
Right, exactly.
You turn this into a parable. What are you saying with it?
Well, isn't it interesting that here you've got the most contemporary of contemporary people, those who are at the forefront of science and technology, who are basically saying precisely the same thing that these ancient scriptural texts say, that this is one planet, we're one family. And if you think that we go around this thing, we can't even see any boundaries that you guys are fighting each other over. If you could, another astronaut, Russell Schweikert, an American, said, you know, I see this thing and it's so beautiful. And I just want to take these people who are fighting over imaginary lines, one in each hand, and I want to say, look at it. Just look at it from this perspective. And these guys actually formed a society of space explorers and produced a magnificent coffee table book called The Home Planet just to try to get across their new insight from space, which is really the old insight of all the great world religions. Hey, one planet, one people, one humanity.
But I know you. You're still a preacher, still working in parables here. Parables. Are you saying by that to you today, O preacher of yore, the boundaries of religions themselves are meaningless?
No, I'm not saying they're meaningless, but I am saying they're permeable. And that's something that where I really empathize with a lot of particularly young people who talk about being spiritual and not religious. They are willing to look beyond the tradition in which they were brought up to see what those in other traditions might also have to offer them. And some people disparage that. They say, oh, that's just cafeteria religion. You pick a little here, you pick a little there. I think often, of course, it can be that, but I think often it's much more serious. It's saying, look, we know that every tradition sees only a fragment of the truth. Maybe if we put a few fragments together, we can get a fuller picture. There's an image, Tom, that has come to me very, very powerfully in recent years. As I've got to know people from other great world religious traditions. And that is, I picture the world religions rather like siblings who have been separated at birth, and they've been parceled out to different families, and they grow up in families with different traditions, different holidays, different, maybe even different clothing, different food, different geographies. But then somehow they find each other. They come back and they're in the same room. And when they look at each other, having grown up in these very different ways, they recognize a family resemblance. And I think that's what's happening in the world right now, that as people get together, and for example, the world's Parliament of Religions, which met for the first time in 100 years in 1993 and now meets every 5 years, people from all the great religious traditions recognize in each other the family resemblance. And underneath the external differences, they see a common core of reverence for the mystery in which all of our days are set, and a desire to leave the world a little bit better than they found it. And this isn't, this isn't exclusive to them. It's saying, yeah, we got a lot of things different. We can enrich each other with our holidays and our texts and our songs and our prayers, but underneath we've got a spiritual and ethical core that's common, and I believe that.
Richard Watts, Dick Watts is with us. He's author of the new book, Hungers of the Heart. He was also my childhood minister. And Dick, a lot of people are lining up with questions and observations for you. Let's turn to them. He joins us from WGLT at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Candace. Candace, you're on the air with Reverend Watts.
Hello.
Hi. What's your story, Candace?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
What's your story, Candace? What's your thought?
Yes, I actually was brought up with no religion whatsoever, so as I grew older, I did have the hunger, you know, for something more, for something deeper, so I set out on a search, personal search, and tested out a lot of holy books and different religions, and I'm coming from the angle of believing the Bible now. I am a Christian, and what I've noticed is that I think that people, they say that they're spiritual but not religious, because that would mean that they would have to change their behaviors. You know, change would mean making a change on their part. So another huge missing link is that people aren't really taking in accurate knowledge. And, you know, they're taking in knowledge, they're hearing things. The Bible foretold these things, but they're not taking in accurate knowledge for themselves. They're just listening to people who we obviously see can be corrupt. And it's really a personal thing. You have to really want it. There's many scriptures that talk about that.
Candace, let us pick it up right there, if we may, and I really appreciate your call. Dick, you hear Candace saying, you know, a lot of people who say they're spiritual, not religious, take that path because, in her view, it's easier. You don't have to sign up for any, you know, rule book.
Well, first of all, I respect Candace's search, that she went out and did her own study and came to a place that made sense to her. Sure, it's possible that there are people who say I'm spiritual but not religious because they don't want the discipline or they don't want the effort of study to light down in a particular place. You know, everybody can't be a tourist always. Sometime we have to come home, and it's good to have that spiritual home. On the other hand, let's just stipulate that we can find fakery everywhere, whether it's among religious or spiritual or scientifically, skeptically minded. So I think that what's going on with many people who call themselves spiritual but not religious is they are looking at the Jerry Falwells, and they're seeing in the media the signs that say Jesus hates fags, and they're looking at intolerance, and they're saying, I can't be part of that. I know in myself that there's something deep at the heart of reality that I honor and respect. There are things to me that are sacred and that I'll bet my life on, but I sure don't want to be a part of that stuff, and one can only empathize with them.
But let me ask you then, because you're right. You go right to the question. You say, but if we – and this doesn't apply to Candace, but it applies to the audience, I guess, that you're addressing here. You say, but if we no longer trust that there is some authority, whether book or church, with inside information on the divine will, what are we to trust? And you raise the question. You say, what does it mean to live a good life without absolute external rules? What might it look like to be a person of spiritual integrity in the 21st century? If a person is unchurched or unmosqued or unsynagogued or untempled, you name it, and yet they say, I'm spiritual, not religious, what does that look like? How do you know if you're living the good life?
Well, one of the key words in the question that you raised, Tom, is the word absolute. Mm. I'm not arguing, have never argued, that in the great religious traditions, there is no wisdom that can guide our search. I believe that there is, and you and I were talking earlier about some of the forms of that wisdom. But in terms of having absolutes, I think we live in our world with fragmentary truth, and that we do injustice to our search when we pretend that we know more than in fact we know. So my idea of the spiritual search is not that we have nothing that we can count on. For example, one of the great atheist writers, Sam Harris, mm-hmm. In his book, The End of Faith, says, look, the fact that we have certain intuitions about what life is about and what the ethical life is does not mean that they're insubstantial. And he goes on to say, Jesus, for example, in the Golden Rule, do to others as you would have them do unto you. This is an insight that is universal, is substantial, and we can bet our life on it. So what he's fighting is not an understanding of religion that centers in that kind of ethic and spirituality. What he's fighting is the kind of absolute, I've got the truth, you don't, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. You know, that kind of fundamentalism that offends his sense of both science and reason. Mm. So to say that we are spiritual but not part of an institution or organization is not to say that we have no firm standing point. We just don't pretend to know what is beyond our knowing. Life really comes down to mystery with a capital M. And a lot of people, when they use the word God, are simply referring to that deep sense of mystery forever beyond understanding. Mm.
All right, Dick, let's take that for a minute. But how do you sustain that across generations? I mean, this way of looking at religion is one that essentially has grown up in your lifetime and mine in many ways, not exclusively, but it's become popular now. But you quote, for example, Diana Athill. She's a British literary figure, wrote Somewhere Toward the End. And she's right. Not religious. And she says, we, the irreligious, live within social structures built by the religious. And she says her own understanding of right behavior, she says, is the behavior taught to me, that's her, by my Christian family. So if you don't have that, if you have people sort of searching off into spirituality without that external authority of religion, what sustains and transmits and teaches the right path, Dick?
Well, I think that's a great question. There was a marvelous book called Habits of the Heart, I suppose, about 20 years ago, where that referred to the religion of Sheilaism, because Sheila had a religion that was all her own. Well, I respect the Sheilas who find their own way, but I have a part of my book which is titled That Awful Institutional Church. And I'm inviting people to entertain the suspicion that there's something positive about being part of an organized institutional church. And it is what you're referring to, that every good idea has to be incarnated. It has to take some tangible form. And if we are to transfer the deepest insights we've had about life, whether it's to our children, certainly, we have to teach. We have to share some practices. And churches and mosques and temples at their best are enabling people to live with some accumulated wisdom. Tradition is nothing other than democracy that includes the dead. Accumulated wisdom and finding a way to share, to break out of their loneliness, to share their search with others who are similarly searching, and to have something to pass down to the next generation. That's why I wrote this book. It began, I'll tell you more about how it began after our
time. That's great. We'll take a short break right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the millions of Americans who say they are spiritual, not religious, and what that means. My guest is Richard Watts, Dick Watts, author of Hungers of the Heart. He also happens to have been my childhood minister in central Illinois decades back now. He joins us from WGLT at Illinois State University. Dick, this is a lot of fun in this day and age. Here's Anne Richmond, and she writes on Facebook, I too am a child of a former pastorate of Richard Watts, Lakewood Presbyterian Church, I guess in Cleveland, Ohio, Dick. She says she appreciates hearing you again. Here's another FM. This is 23 seconds ago on Facebook. Yes, not just a bunch of rules or a God that we have to placate continually. Spiritual, universal principles we can live by. Humility, FM writes, is not pretending that we know more than we know. I agree, he writes. But then here's Elmridge, Dick, who says of you, but he is denying the divinity of Jesus. What about that, Reverend Watts?
Well, one of the things that we need to do is we always need to read texts in context. When we don't do that, we get into big trouble. Now, for example, if I tell you that there's, I know of somebody in the first century who was called divine, the Son of God, and the Savior, you know, who do you suppose I'm talking about? Well, most people would say you're talking about Jesus. No, I'm talking about Caesar Augustus. Caesar Augustus received all of those divine titles. And so when Christians talked about Jesus and what they had encountered in his life, they used titles which were very countercultural. They were saying, look, if you want to know what life is about, if you want to know where real power is, if you want to know where divinity is, look at this peasant going around talking about creating a new community of compassion and love. Don't look for the seat of power for the emperor in Rome.
Let us accept
that's
that. I doubt if Elmer just meaning. I get it, but I doubt he's thinking that you should be attributing divinity to Caesar even 2,000 years later. But he's in a way asking, with this very open, searching view that you've adopted in the years since you and I were in the same sanctuary, are you still a Christian? Do you believe in the divinity of Jesus, or does that matter to you? And what about believers in other faiths? Are you suggesting—
I don't think that those two things go together, being a Christian and believing in the divinity of Jesus. Jesus was a man among men, a man who revealed the nature of God and God's will for the way human beings should live together in community. Was Jesus— What on earth could that possibly mean, that he had 23 human chromosomes and 23 divine chromosomes? That's the kind of absurdity that one gets into when one takes theological language literally instead of simply as metaphorical language.
So what does
and that's
being
the way
a Christian
we need to
mean
understand
to you,
that.
Then? Is it lifestyle? Is it morality? What does
well,
it mean?
Christianity in the very beginning, before it was called Christianity— Tom, it was called the Way, the Way. And it was a way of life. It was a lifestyle. Now, that doesn't mean that that lifestyle was devoid of a basis of belief. Of course there was. But it was a lifestyle long before it was a creed. And I think we need to get over our hang-up with absolute creeds and get back to the lifestyle, a lifestyle which is nonviolent, which is compassionate, which is inclusive, which creates community instead of holding other people off at arm's length. Yes, it is a matter of lifestyle.
Wow. It's a way since the old pew. You quote Amos from the Old Testament, from the Jewish scripture here.
I
despise you. Talking about, I guess, those wrapped up in the institutional religions. I despise your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But then he says, and this is a phrase that all Americans know from Martin Luther King Jr., if you got it there in front of you, Dick.
I do. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. You know, really, this is at the heart of biblical understanding, that we have an understanding of God who really is not terribly interested in religion, but is passionately interested in human society and the way that people behave with one another. You know, it was just within the last year that Glenn Beck had an astonishing comment on his show where he said, you know, if you go to your church's website and you see that it says social justice or economic justice, run in the other direction. Am I asking people to leave their churches? He said, yes, I am. Well, Glenn Beck got it absolutely wrong. Social justice, economic justice, are not code words for some kind of leftist plot. They are absolutely integral to the whole biblical understanding of who God is and what God's people should be about. We are about trying to create a more fair, a more just, a more equitable world.
Let me take a call.
That's at the heart of the faith.
Let me get a call right here, Dick, from Boston. And Crystal. Crystal, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Dick Watts.
Thank you so much, and I love your show, and I think that this is particularly a really good and important conversation to be having. I have been a person who's considered myself spiritual but not religious since I was about 13. I've attended every different kind of religious service, from Southern Baptist to Zen Buddhist, always curious in the beliefs of others and other people's lifestyles and cultures. I come from a family with really no religion, and my husband comes from a Hindu background. My question is, how do we, if we are people who consider ourselves spiritual but not religious and are curious in other people's beliefs and see common threads between others who are religious and ourselves, how do we speak with each other? How do we interact with each other? If we recognize these commonalities in one another, and yet there are those differences, especially as the world, you know, becomes more complex and we get to know people who are unlike ourselves, how do we communicate with one another on a day-to-day basis? I was wondering if your guest has any thoughts on that.
And do you mean in particular, Crystal, for a more broadly defined spiritual seeker like yourself, communicating with the more traditionally religious or something else?
I do, yeah, because I've had definitely individual conversations, but it always seems to come down to, you know, if you're religious, you know certain things to be true, you know, best just by definition of your religion, and I don't know those things to be true, and that's kind of where the conversation stops. I always think that's such a shame. I'd always like to go, you know, beyond that and keep the conversation going, but it always seems to come to a stopping point, which I think is really unfortunate. So I'm just wondering if your guest has any ideas on how to keep that conversation going and keep the lines of communication open, not just to shut ourselves off from one another.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, Crystal, and I thank you for it. Dick Watts, what about it? How do you have that conversation without it becoming a fight, which would seem not the point?
Well, I think Crystal's question is a wonderful question, and I really commend her for it. The hardest conversations to have are usually the ones within one's own faith. It's often easier to talk to people of a quite different faith than those in your own faith who may consider you to be a heretic or somehow apostate. The best counsel that I have is that when we talk to somebody, to talk in terms of our stories. So rather than arguing positions and doctrines, try saying, well, here is the point of view to which I have come, and here are the experiences I've had that have brought me to that point. Tell me how you came to your viewpoint and what it means to you. Now, if a person is unwilling to accept that invitation, then probably a conversation isn't going to go very far. But I think that's a great opener. The other thing that I would say to Crystal is, beyond speaking to people that you don't have an immediate rapport with, I hope that you will go find some people who, like you, out of whatever tradition they come, are seekers and are open and are not feeling threatened, but actually enriched by talking with somebody from a different point of view. And, you know, sit around your kitchen table with five other people. I'd even put in a plug. Let all those five people be reading Hungers of the Heart and talking about what is in those chapters. But we all need not only to hone our ability to talk with adversaries, but we also need to have a support community of people who are asking the same kinds of questions we are. And, Crystal, I sure hope you find that community.
Dick, have you been run out of churches for this very open view of spirituality that you've pursued?
No.
I mean,
no, I think one of the best-kept secrets is there are all kinds of churches who represent the kind of viewpoint that I've been expressing this morning. They don't often make the media. You know, this is part of our problem. What you see on the media is a very small slice of American religion. And, you know, if somebody in a backwoods in Tennessee gets bit while snake handling during a church service, I guarantee it'll be in tomorrow's paper. But when people are going to their Methodist Church or UCC or Episcopal Church, and they're talking about the kinds of issues we are here today, I don't suppose that's very newsworthy and we're not going to hear about it.
But you know,
but the
numbers.
Whole world of religion, you know, the whole world of religion is not the world of pedophile priests and of exclusive people who think that the rapture is going to come week after next.
That's fine, so, but I really have to ask you, I get that.
Yeah.
But you know very well, as do many other preachers, that the kind of mainline Protestant churches that you're describing who might be the most open to this sort of open-minded liberal conversation are the ones who have seen their attendance just go through the floor in the last decades. Why is that?
Well, part of that's a great question, and part of the problem is I have to lay at the feet of clergy. It seems to me that an awful lot of clergy never bother to teach the people what they themselves have learned. And so people are sort of fundamentalists by default, because these sorts of questions that you and I are talking about mm-hmm. today are not often raised. And I know that in mainline churches, there are all kinds of people sitting there never receiving permission to raise their questions, never having the opportunity to engage in give and take about what their life experience has taught them or what their life experience has asked them. Let me tell you a very brief story. There was a scholar in the Jesus Seminar, which works to uncover the facts about the historical Jesus, okay. who was giving a talk to a group of Missouri Synod Lutherans, a mm-hmm. very conservative denomination. And he was talking about New Testament documents and the document Q, which is a lost document of the sayings of Jesus. And then came time for the question period, and he wondered, you know, he felt like Daniel in the lion's den, and a woman stood up, and instead of addressing the speaker, she turned around to address her preacher in the pew behind her, and she said to him, "Did you know about Q?" And he said, "Well, yeah." She said, "Why didn't you tell us?" And I think that's a very powerful parable, that our churches are full of people who are questioning, who are curious, but who are not being adequately taught. And so I think that's a great challenge for my colleagues in ministry, with whom, by the way, I empathize greatly.
Let's get a call from Jamestown, North Dakota. James is on the line. Hi, James. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you, Tom. Thank you, Reverend Watt. I love your message. I'm afraid that church attendance in our community is not going through the roof, that most people are not receiving the spiritual nourishment that I think is the intent, and all this dogma and ritual that most people associate with religiosity and this mania about I am right and you are wrong is really spiritual death.
James, I appreciate your call. Our time is so short. I'm really glad to hear from you in North Dakota. And let me get one more right here. Jeff in Brighton, Massachusetts. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah. I just want to say that I guess I consider myself spiritual as opposed to religious. I think spiritual is somebody else's word. I just take that to mean that I do sort of feel a personal connection to God. The idea of whether or not I'm religious, you know, I was raised Jewish at a conservative temple, mm-hmm. and I really found no connection to it. And I've sort of looked to pursue other religions just to see if there was something there for me, but I never found anything. And I find where people often go wrong is that they feel like they need to find something. I've just got to a point where I feel like I don't need to fill that void. I don't feel it as a void. I feel that I'm content without any religion in my life.
So
content with my own connection in God.
So that hunger of the heart that Dick Watts has right in his title, you don't feel it anymore. You're not feeling an absence.
Well, I feel satisfied with my own personal connection. I feel like the idea that there needs to be a connection through some structured channel is it's just a matter of circumstance that there happen to be options like that.
Jeff, I appreciate your call so much, and I thank you for it. Dick Watts, that's the last caller we're going to get to. He's happy with his personal relationship. And I guess that what that leaves me wondering is, in this view, this open-minded, open-hearted view of spirituality you're offering, it comes back to how does it get sustained? I mean, you know, Diane Ethill saying, you know, even I, the irreligious, took a lot from religion. If those churches are empty, or those mosques, or those synagogues one day, who carries the flame? How does this go on, Dick?
Well, one of the stories of church history across the centuries is that it is reformed over and over and over again. When things get stultified, when they get brittle, when there's hardening of the theological arteries. And so there may be many people listening to you this morning who are having their own search, finding their own answers. And when they find themselves lonely or in need, they may be the people who will gather four or five other people. They'll sit around a table in their home, and they will be part of a new Reformation. It doesn't have to depend on the churches, the synagogues, the temples. It can start with an individual or two who just share over a cup of coffee. And I think the Reformation of our day is going to be, it's sort of like a Facebook Reformation, where people are going to talk to themselves and create their own new structures. And I say blessings on you when you do it.
The Reverend Richard Watts, author of the new book, Hungers of the Heart, Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century. Dick Watts, you were a great guide. When I was knee-high to a grasshopper, it's amazing to see how much thinking and growth you've done since then. I'll try and keep up. I'm really grateful for your time today. Thank you so much for your thinking, your
Tom,
insights.
Tom, thank you for the opportunity, Tom, and it's great to be with you again.
Wonderful to have you. Richard Watts, Hungers of the Heart. Listeners, thank you for joining us. Good luck on your search. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.